Chapter 6. They kept a methodical pace for about half an hour, pausing every so often whenever Ames went still to survey their surroundings. As they stalked through the forest, Elith found herself increasingly impressed by the others in their small group, though it was no surprise to her that Karush could move with such fluid quiet. The fact that his machine companion could flow across the terrain with similar grace was astonishing, almost to the point of being unnerving. More than once she found herself looking back to verify that Subo's feet were in fact touching the ground, and that it wasn't just floating above the surface like some metal cloud. And even Sardis was competent in the wild, moving with quiet steps and sure footing. It clearly wasn't his natural environment, but he avoided the clomping mistakes of the novice she'd expected him to be, and demonstrated a level of attentiveness that put him on par with a seasoned hunter. Though she didn't want to admit it, the more she saw the envoy in action, the more respect she felt building for him. She doubted she'd ever be able to admire the man, and she certainly would never trust him. But witnessing firsthand his alertness and skill in the wilderness gave her some measure of confidence that he wasn't the blustering, bumbling bureaucrat she'd first taken him to be. As good as they were, though, none of them were in the same class as Captain Ames. He was among the best movers she'd seen, including her own former sisters from the Order of the Voice. He seemed to intuit the natural rhythm of their environment and moved effortlessly through it, with it, as though he was as much a part of it as the wind or the trees. And when he stopped moving, he might as well have been part of the landscape. His skill was made all the more impressive by the otherwise uncanny stillness of the wood. She had noticed it the instant they'd crossed the threshold of the tree line. Despite the vibrancy of color and lushness of plant life, there was an emptiness to the forest that made it feel like a brightly lacquered mausoleum. And the longer they walked, the heavier that sense became, until it was almost oppressive. It wasn't silent exactly. The trees whispered and rustled in the light breeze. Their gentle footsteps stirred the air as they padded over the dead limbs, leaves and needles cast off and scattered on the forest floor. But for all the appearances of healthy vegetation, Elith couldn't shake the feeling that they were the only truly living things in that wood. "The thing I don't get," Ames said, his sudden words shocking after so long a silence, "is where is all the wildlife?" He stopped and turned back to face them. His posture straightened and fell relaxed, giving up on trying to remain unnoticed for the moment, as though the game of hide-and-seek had been declared over and he the winner. The rest of the group caught up to him while he stood looking around. He shrugged and shook his head. "I get that maybe we're the first humans to walk these woods," he said, "so maybe every bird and beast ran off to hide. But all this, and not a single print, no nests, no beds, no runs, no scat. I haven't even seen a single insect." He looked over to Elith. "This feel right to you?" She shook her head. "Yeah," he said. "Me neither." "It does seem odd," Sardis said, "particularly when so much else seems familiar. I'll inquire of Oyun when we return. This strikes me as the sort of detail one would have noted if one were being thorough in one's research." "The knocking stopped," Karush said. Elith had been so intent on the moment-to-moment of her surroundings that it hadn't registered with her that she hadn't heard the strange sound since they'd entered the wood. "I couldn't hear it while I was on the Adirin," she said. "How frequently had it been happening?"
"Started up a little while after the supplies touched down," Ames said. "Got more active over an hour or so."
"And then gave up? As soon as we came out to find it?" Elith said. "A shy spirit of the wood, perhaps?" Sardis said.
Whatever it was, can we assume for the time being that it does not represent a threat to our humble camp?
I don't know, sir, Ames answered. Not finding a thing doesn't mean there's not a thing to find.
Oyun's sensor array should be functional in another, Sardis said, and paused briefly to check the time. Hour, at most. I'm inclined to let him take up the search for the source. There doesn't appear to be much point for us to continue pursuing it if it doesn't care for our presence.
Might as well get a couple of readings while we're out, Ames said. Give the Arbiter a little something to work with.
Sardis glanced around the woods, still seeming impatient, as though they were running behind some unspoken schedule. But Elith was starting to get the impression that that was just his normal state of being.
Fine, he said. 10 minutes and then back to camp.
Ames nodded and gestured to Elith. I don't guess that happens to be time enough for you to do your, He held up a hand and waggled his fingers.
Analysis? Elith said.
Sure, I guess.
It isn't magic, Captain, she said. Just a different way to read than you're used to.
I'll take your word for it.
That's not a bad policy.
But no, not nearly enough time. If I'm working steadily, it usually takes a couple of days to get a baseline. And then after that, it can be a week or so to build a comprehensive profile.
How comprehensive does it need to be? Sardis asked.
That depends on what you want me to do exactly, she answered. Care to tell me what that is?
That depends entirely on what we find, Sardis said. 9 minutes.
All right, Ames said, and he waved a hand at Sardis, Karush, and Subo. You three hang tight here for 9 minutes while the aspirant and I take a quick look around. Wari Karush, I trust you'll keep the envoy from doing anything silly.
Karush dipped his head in acknowledgement. Ames nodded and escorted Elith away from the group.
I guess do what you can, Ames said. We'll try to get a proper trip put together once the envoy settles down.
It won't be much, Elith answered, but I can get a start.
They parted, with Ames headed off toward something that had already caught his attention a few yards away. Elith walked several paces from the others and then stopped with her back to them and took a long inhale. She closed her eyes for a few moments, settling into a sense of the place, felt her connection to it expand beyond the borders of herself. It was true that establishing a baseline for her planetary analysis would take about 2 standard days if she were following normal First House protocols. But during her time on Quell, with Eth Amuin, he'd taught her a new way to interpret the vital energies within a world, and afterward, in her exile, she'd reevaluated the techniques of the House, explored the edges and gaps of her teachings, and developed an enhanced method of her own. It would bring her neither quantifiable data to evaluate nor hard scientific evidence to assess. But if she executed the technique properly, then the world itself might tell her where to begin. She fixed her mind on her purpose and let the words of the deep language rise to her lips. Dawn chases shadow. Blossom greets the day. When she opened her eyes again, she let her vision go wide and unfocused to absorb the sweep of view before her, the impression of the place taken all at once. For several minutes she held still, allowing the unique quality of sensation that the wood created to imprint itself on her, to sink into her being. This was her first true introduction to Quell's shadow, the first genuine moment of greeting free from the distraction and confusion created by the presence and activity of all the others. And as she opened herself to what this unique world had to offer, she felt it, too, begin to unfurl itself hesitantly before her. It would take days of careful study to discern the foundational patterns within the planet's composition. But in these first few minutes, Elith allowed the wide band ripple of the terrain
the sharp-edged freshness of the air, the trace humidity in the breeze on her cheeks, to all mingle together to shape a sensation within her, like a tide rising timidly to meet her. The broad strokes washed over her, each revealing a subtle touch of the signature of the world, each drawing her by gradual degree into greater alignment with its singular form of self-expression. No matter how many times she had done it, Elith had always been awed by the complex vitality deep within the heart of each world. Even in the sickest of the planets she'd had to put down for the Ascendants, there was something radiantly precious about the unique story of its formation, buried within its many layers, told by its intricate pattern of thread lines running throughout. And Quell had taught her how to truly listen to the silent anthem each world lifted in reverence to the cosmos. But here on Quell's shadow, the first notes of its resonant song generated the barest hint of a discordant overtone, a harmonic variation at odds with her many years of experience with nature. The impression struck her something like hearing a voice humming a familiar tune, but with the wrong rhythm. Someone singing the echo of a song, or perhaps mechanically repeating a sacred hymn without having grasped its meaning. It was a wisp of smoke at the edge of perception, and she knew reaching for it would only obliterate the fragile strands. Her training kicked in, held off the temptation to strain her senses, and Elith rested in the moment, knowing her stillness would allow space for the impression to grow sharper, more apparent.
4 minutes, Sardis called from behind her.
The slow wave of energy building within Elith collapsed completely at the harsh edge of his voice.
In case you actually wanted to do something while we are here, he said.
Elith resisted the urge to turn around to address him. Whether she answered with a cutting response or a humble one, either would acknowledge the provocation. Sardis seemed to thrive on the reactions he induced in others. Ignoring him seemed to be both the wisest course and the cruelest. Whatever she'd begun to sense about the place was lost for the moment, the impression too ephemeral for her to hold in her mind. It would be difficult to recover until she could find some measure of genuine solitude. Until then, she'd have to make do with the more technical side of her analysis. Fortunately, even in the immediate vicinity, there was sufficient botanical diversity to begin. She pulled her set of collection instruments from her pack and gathered a few samples of the most easily accessible variety, a scrap of papery bark, a bit of spongy gray moss, a segment of a woody fungal bloom. While she did so, she gained a deeper appreciation for the gloves Tal had provided her. They left the sensitivity of her touch so intact that she was able to handle the delicate bark with care and feel the velvet texture of the moss through them. Yet, when she tested her fingertip against the fine point of one of her tools, the sharpness somehow remained apparent without ever passing into pain, no matter how hard she pressed against it. And the ill-advised experiment left no trace or mark on the glove. For a brief flash, Elith wondered what instruments the house might be able to develop with the Hezra's aid if only the blending of their two disciplines had not been forbidden at the founding of the Ascendants. But the thought quickly vanished. Whatever discoveries or progress might have been accelerated, there was no doubt that humanity would have soon after erased itself with such power. Captain Ames returned as she was capping a sample of surface soil. And though his pace suggested he hadn't found anything dangerous, his expression still showed focused concern while he tried to work out the strangeness of the wood.
"No bears, Captain Ames," Sardis said as he approached. "No bears, no spiders, no wasps," Ames answered, "which, normally, I'd be glad of."
Elith chuckled at the response, at the unusual combination of creatures in his list, reading in it something of his personal distaste for them. For a warrior, so at ease in the wilderness, he seemed unusually uptight about bugs.
Hey, those are the three great terrors of the wild, he said, mock seriously. Everybody knows that. It's just science.
Your courage is truly inspirational, Captain, Sardis said. What's your assessment?
My assessment is that this place is weird, sir. That's about all I've got so far.
It looks familiar enough, the envoy said, to my admittedly amateur eye at any rate.
He stepped to a nearby tree with his hands behind his back, leaned closer to inspect it. It was tall, slender-trunked, with a sprout of leaves high at the top, and coiled by a thin vine with delicate blossoms.
Tendril rose, I believe, he said, identifying the vine. This forest could be on any of 1,000 Ascendants worlds I've visited.
That's probably why it feels so weird, Ames said, looking up at the patchwork canopy above them. Looks like what you'd expect, without actually being it.
I don't know.
Sardis let out a quiet grunt, a sound Elith initially took as acknowledgement of Ames's statement. But when she glanced at the envoy, she saw he was looking at the fingers of his left hand. A moment later, he removed his glove and revealed a crimson streak along his pointer. He pressed his thumb against it, and a bright bead formed near the fingertip.
Well, he said, that's unexpected.
He held his finger up and turned it to show them the drop of blood. I'll have to file a complaint with my tailor. Went right through the glove.
Ames was by his side in a moment.
What did you touch? He said. Show me exactly.
Sardis pointed to the offending plant and started to reach toward it, but Ames stopped him.
Don't touch it again.
Captain, I'm not fool enough to let it bite me twice, Sardis said. And despite Ames's warning, he gently raised the head of one of the flowers on the vine to show the stem beneath. To his credit, he did avoid injury this time.
Ames produced a knife from his belt and then carefully slid the blade under the stem to support it while he gently pushed the envoy's hand away. He continued to move Sardis aside, farther back from the plant, and then stepped in to study the stem up close. Elith watched him work, noted how intently he studied the vine's features and read its structure.
These little devils, he said. I see why you didn't notice them. They're almost clear, like glass. I can't tell if they're thorns or just really stiff bristles. They look worse than needles, though.
He turned back to Sardis. How do you feel? Any lightheadedness? Heart rate increase? Blood rush of any kind?
I am in excruciating pain, Captain, as you can see, Sardis said flatly.
Sir, this isn't a joke. Your body just got compromised by unidentified flora.
It's a tendril rose. They're on 10,000 worlds. It looks like a tendril rose. Looks and is aren't the same thing.
I'm fine, Ames. He held his finger closer to Ames's face. Already stopped bleeding. And it didn't even leave a splinter. Still, shouldn't have gotten through your glove. I concur, hence my complaint.
Ames turned back to the plant and studied it for a few moments longer.
Yeah, he said finally. Yeah, I think I see the one that got you. Doesn't look like it broke off. It's still got a little blood on it.
In it, maybe.
He turned his head, checked the stem from multiple angles. It does look like it's inside.
Interesting. And maybe good. At least maybe that means it didn't inject you with anything.
Ames gingerly took hold of a tendril and excised a portion of it with surgeon's hands.
Still, better get toxicology on this, he said, and we better head back right now just in case.
We're 3 minutes behind anyway, Sardis replied, donning his glove. I assume our return can be at a quicker pace than our timid entrance.
We can pick it up, sure. I don't think we need to worry too much about making a racket now. Just watch your footing, and don't touch anything else.
Sardis made an exaggeratedly dramatic gesture to invite the captain to lead the way back.
Ames moved out, and the others followed closely behind, no longer leaving the gaps between them that he'd enforced on their way into the wood. The brief exploration and the lack of wildlife had made the forest seem less threatening, but something sinister remained in its emptiness. They kept the pace up, a more purposeful walk than the stalking approach they'd taken before. But even with Ames's explicit statement about no longer needing to be concerned about noise, each member of the group still seemed compelled to make themselves as small as possible. Eleth felt the pressure to move quietly herself, beyond her normal, natural propensity for it, as though the wood demanded it of them. They had traveled about 20 minutes when the knocking sound started up again, somewhere behind and to the left of them. Ames froze in place at the first occurrence, and the others followed suit, but turned to face the direction of the disturbance. The knocks continued in their slow rhythm, identical in interval, just as before. But the nature of the sound had changed. Closer, certainly, but now with a subterranean quality, a deep, cavernous thrum underlying each dull, wooden impact. After several seconds, a second source joined the first, this one coming from the opposite side and somewhat farther away. The intervals of each seemed the same, though their rhythms were slightly offset. The effect created an unmistakable impression of a heartbeat. But gradually, though the change in timing was imperceptible, the rhythms unified, and the sounds merged until Eleth lost the sense of directionality and instead felt that she was at the center of a single drum. Both continued for nearly a minute, the longest she'd heard thus far. When the beats finally ceased and the wood fell quiet again, the emptiness of the place seemed magnified, as did the sense that none of them belonged there.
"I don't think I liked that," Ames said.
"Karush," Sardis said, "did you happen to get a range on that?"
"No, sir," Karush answered. "Waveforms were indeterminate. Too broad to pinpoint."
"Of course they were. I'm really not certain why we bother to invest in such," Sardis replied, waving a dismissive hand at Subo while he searched for a term.
"Instruments, if they're no better than our own ears."
"Indeterminate origin," Subo said politely.
Ella thought the machine was repeating Karush's report until she saw Karush's head snap to look at it.
"On vector."
"Acquire," Karush said.
"Acquired."
"Am I supposed to understand any of that?" Sardis said.
But Karush ignored him, stepped past him with an intense look. Eleth felt the hair on her neck stand on end without understanding why.
"Range?"
Karush asked.
200 meters, Subo replied. 32 seconds.
"That sounds bad," Ames said.
He brought his rifle to his shoulder, muzzle pointed to the ground, but ready to engage in a heartbeat. If only he knew with what to engage.
"Karush,"
Sardis said.
Karush didn't reply, but Subo responded in surprising fashion. The machine stepped behind Sardis and unfolded its outer shell, its innumerable microsegments blossoming and streaming out in a manner somewhere between a swarm of insects and the roots of a tree growing at hyperspeed. The components formed a dense latticework encasing the envoy. At the same time, two small pods emerged from Subo's core chassis, rolling up and to either side to where its shoulders would have been if it hadn't refactored itself.
"Karush!" Sardis shouted. "Karush!"
But still, Karush took no notice of the envoy. He stood 10 feet ahead of Subo, and though his stance was relaxed, he had the look of a storm cloud summoning its power to unleash a thunderbolt.
"Karush!"
Sardis called again.
"This is unacceptable!"
15 seconds, Subo said,
its voice perfectly calm.
"Karush?"
Ames said. Karush raised a hand, actually acknowledging the captain and gesturing for him to wait. 10 seconds, Subo reported. The shape came over a rise, 40 yards distant, directly in line with Karush and Subo. Ames snapped his weapon up, but Karush shot his arm out sideways, signaling for the captain to hold fire. At first sight, Elith took it for a large mammal, but almost immediately, that impression gave way to one more insect-like. What it was, she couldn't tell, but the way it moved sent a surge of revulsion through her, like witnessing a serpent in its death throes or the twitching of half-crushed spider. It made barely any sound, other than a clicking sort of shuffle across the forest floor, and it covered the ground way too fast. The thing rapidly closed the distance to Karush 20 yards away, but he stood motionless, waiting. His void edge hung on his chest, ready for sudden and devastating deployment. And though Elith felt certain that's what he was preparing to do, the creature was so close and so fast, she doubted even he was quick enough to draw it in time. To her surprise, he didn't even twitch a hand toward it. Instead, when the creature got within 10 yards of him, Subo emitted a brief, low hum. An instant later, the pods on its frame sent forth 6 ribbons of purple-tinged light. Silent, luminous beams that arced and then converged, passing like wraiths through the beast and into the ground beyond. The creature collapsed instantly and impacted heavily, its momentum carrying it a yard or two before it came to a complete rest. They all stood in silence for a few moments, staring at the thing lying in a heap before them. Sardis, as usual, was the first to speak.
Karush, let me out of this thing.
Karush made no acknowledgement, but the latticework surrounding the envoy retracted as Subo assumed its typical form. As soon as he was able, Sardis strode out of his protective cage and within arm's length of the creature.
I am not a child, Azirim, he said as he passed Karush. You absolutely may not have your pet do that again.
It is the will of the Hezra Ka that you be protected, Karush answered, and I serve his will.
His delivery of the response was the epitome of etiquette and respect, but the message was clear. When it came to fulfilling his duties, he was not the envoys to command.
There's no shame in getting buttoned up, sir, Ames said, approaching the creature cautiously. I would have gotten in there with you if there'd been a door.
Elith joined the two men by the carcass, and though its twitching movements had ceased, the sense of revulsion it created continued. Even up close, it was difficult to identify. The creature was a mottled gray-brown lump, a confused mass of features, both mammalian and insectoid, lying on what Elith guessed was its side. The majority of its body was covered in a spiny fur, like the quills of a hedgehog, punctuated by patches of sleek carapace around its joints, roughly the size of a small bear. It had 6 limbs of different sizes, unusually arranged. The rear legs were stout and slightly shorter than the others. The remaining 4 were paired on each side, 1 thick like a beetle and 1 thin like a spider, and joined together at the creature's shoulder, if it could be called a shoulder. The body wasn't segmented like an insect's, but its limbs and their mode of articulation were most similar to that of an arthropod, except at their tips. The legs ended in a strange split configuration that reminded Elith of a partially open Venus flytrap, or eyelids with sparse lashes. Each half was ridged with 8 long, finger-like protrusions, and each protrusion had many joints that appeared to give them grasping capabilities somewhere between a human hand and a tentacle. Whether hand or foot, there was something undeniably root-like about their look, as though plant life, too, had been incorporated in the creature's development. And now that she'd made that connection,
her perception of the body shape shifted to include not just mammalian features, but fungal ones as well, like an enormous mushroom cap. If it possessed eyes or mouth, Elith couldn't readily recognize them.
Well, it would seem this place isn't totally devoid of wildlife, Sardis said,
and though he spoke calmly, Elith detected a hint of a tremor in his voice.
Captain Ames, what precisely are we looking at?
Scientifically speaking, Ames said, my new worst nightmare.
That's not particularly insightful.
No, sir, it is not. But it's all I got at the moment. Looks like someone took the awful parts of a bear, a spider, and a wasp and squashed them all together.
Do you have a hypothesis on why we didn't detect it before?
Ames stared at the abomination for a few moments before shaking his head.
Because I have no idea what we'd even be looking for, I guess?
He pointed to various features as he spoke.
Body shape makes me think it'd be a nesting critter, but no guess on where. Could be underground, could be in the rocks, could be in the water, for all I can tell. No mouth I can see, so I couldn't tell you what it eats. And feet, or whatever those are, like that, I'm guessing they don't leave much in the way of tracks. At least not that we'd recognize as such. I'm not even sure it's normally ground-dwelling.
He glanced up at the trees above them. The implication sent a shiver through Elith.
Its intent was undoubtedly hostile, Sardis said. Territorial, maybe,
Ames replied.
Or a hunter, Karush said.
Ames lifted his weapon and examined it briefly, and then extended his foot and hazarded a gentle poke of the beast's back with the toe of his boot.
I'm glad you were here, Subo, old buddy, he said. I'm not sure I could have put this thing down on my own.
It seems so out of place, Elith said. Sardis looked at her.
Elucidate, he said.
She gestured at the landscape around them. As you said before, everything else here looks like it could be on any of a thousand Ascendance worlds, but this thing, she shook her head.
Yeah, never seen anything like it, Ames finished.
No, Elith said. That's not quite it. We have seen things like it. You said it yourself. It looks like a composite of different species, of different kinds of life, but not like life itself. For all the nature out here, there's nothing natural about it.
And yet, it is not entirely alien either, Sardis said.
He was watching her intently, but not in his usual challenging way. His mind was working in parallel to hers, integrating her thoughts with his in rapid analysis.
Indeed, indeed. I believe I see what you mean, Exile. A curious world, this. Like, but not same.
Elith nodded.
Well, he continued, our little excursion has not been a total waste of time, then. Captain Ames, if you'd be so kind as to drop a marker at this location, I'll have the Arbiter direct his initial efforts to this area.
Sure thing, Ames answered.
He glanced down and tapped at a small device attached to his harness.
When we get to camp, I'll bring some of the troopers out to haul this thing back too. Oyun's going to want to get a personal look at it.
I do not share your confidence that he'll want to, Sardis said. But yes, I concur that he should. And let's expedite our return. One such sample is sufficient.
The envoy still projected his usual confident disdain, but the implication was clear enough. He didn't want to wait around for another one of those things to show up any more than the rest of them did.
Yeah, roger that, Ames said. Karush, you want to take rear guard?
Karush nodded his consent and dropped to the back of the line as Ames led the way to camp. Elith noted, though, that Subo remained by Sardis's side for the duration of the journey. By the time they returned, the base camp appeared to be fully operational. Several Hezra troopers stood watch in their towers and at points around the camp's perimeter, but the other few who remained in sight
were sitting together in a casual clump at the center, recovering after their labor. Everyone else, Elith assumed, had disappeared into the various structures. One of the troopers stood as the patrol came in. Elith recognized her as Tal, the woman who'd helped her get her gear together.
"Hey, Pops," Tal called. "Good hunting?"
"The best," Ames replied.
"And lucky you, you get to help me bring it in."
"Seriously?"
"Yeah, we bagged a specimen. Big one. Do me a favor and grab a sled. And bring your friends. And arm up."
"You want to take the skimmer?" she asked,
jerking her thumb at the flatbed utility skimmer parked to one side of the camp. Ames shook his head.
"Tempting. But I want to stay agile just in case."
Tal nodded. Elith could see the weariness on the sergeant's face, but the trooper made no complaint as she went to work. With that exchange, the group broke up. Ames to gather his team for another trip out, Sardis with Karush and Subo to Oyun's structure, undoubtedly to debrief the Arbiter. Elith started to follow the envoy, but he waved her off.
"I'll summon you if I deem it necessary," he said.
Her instinct was to protest, but she stopped herself and instead just nodded. As much as she wanted to hear Oyun's initial reaction to their findings, she knew she'd have a better chance of getting deeper information later, without the envoy around. She wasn't sure what more was expected of her at that point, and she wasn't quite ready to face Nieta again. Instead of returning to the heart of the camp, she found a quiet spot near the edge and sat down on the ground with her back against one of the bunker-like structures. She stayed there for some time, watching the wall of trees across the clearing, allowing her mind to wander where it would as it processed all they'd experienced on their brief excursion. Her unguided thoughts continually returned to the Paragon and her 16 companions, and to Umarai, and most of all, to Dmini. She recalled the tune that Umarai hummed absent-mindedly whenever she performed any sort of manual labor, a liltingly soothing melody somewhere between work song and lullaby from the woman's pre-house childhood, and Dmini's laugh, and her terrible jokes, and the sadness that only showed at the corners of her eyes when she was trying to conceal her feelings. And the Paragon, the illumined mother herself. Though their parting had been a sundering of relationship, Elith found her heart deeply stirred at the thought of the great matriarch of the first house lost in this place. And yet, for all the strangeness she had already encountered on the world, nothing thus far had struck her as anything beyond the Paragon's ability to control or withstand. No matter how she turned it over in her mind, it still seemed incomprehensible to her that the first team's disappearance was purely the result of accident or misfortune. Even so, she knew there was a great deal about the planet yet to be discovered, and she tried to leave a little door open in her thoughts to account for the unknown that might have been the source of the unthinkable. Elith was still reflecting and contemplating when Captain Ames returned with his party, leading their low-hovering sled along behind them. When she first spotted them, she thought from their pace that they were hurrying to return the creature to the Arbiter. But when she glanced again at the sled, she realized it was empty. She rose and met them as they reached the perimeter. Ames was uncharacteristically dark.
"Run into trouble?" she asked.
"Not exactly," Ames answered, "but I'm sure we're in it anyway. Couldn't find the thing."
"Your marker didn't take?"
"Marker was fine. We were in the right spot, no doubt about it.
But whatever that thing was, it's gone now," Ames said. "And I mean gone. Vanished. Poof. Not a single trace."
He continued past her and on toward Oyun's central lab, and Elith knew, just as Ames did, that they were only just beginning to discover how deep the well of trouble ran on this impossible planet.
Chapter 7 Elith lay awake on the cot, staring up at the gentle arc of the ceiling. Exhausted as she was from the day, sleep would not come, and though she didn't want to admit it, the encounter with the horror from the wood and the creature's subsequent disappearance clung to her, filled her with a dark anticipation, as though a horde of its siblings might erupt from the trees at any moment. Beside her, just over arm's length away, Nieta slept soundly on a simple cot of her own, sweetly oblivious to the nebulous dread that Elith felt but could not name, and thus could not command. The Hezra troopers had generously given the two of them quarters to share, separate from the rest of the unit. And though the structure was small and clearly designed for storage, the relative privacy it provided was an unexpected luxury on such an otherwise Spartan site. It may well have been the result of the Hezra's distaste for mingling with them, but in light of the generally kind reception that Ames, Tal, and Oyun had given, Elith chose to receive it as a nice gesture. For a time, she tried to steer her mind towards solving the puzzle of the creature's arrival and disappearance, thinking that if she could treat the mystery rationally, it might steal away the instinctual fear that hovered over her. To no avail. After a solid hour of lying sleeplessly, Elith decided her pure will was insufficient to draw sleep down upon herself. There wasn't room enough in the structure to run through her moving meditation sequence, so she quietly rose and slipped out beneath the night sky of Quell's shadow. The day-night cycle here was roughly 30 standard hours, nearly evenly split between light and darkness. Though the air had cooled, it remained pleasantly mild and called to her mind springtime in the Vaunt, the walled city, home and sanctuary of the first house. The camp was still dark and quiet, but not unguarded. Though she couldn't see them all, Elith knew troopers were standing watch while their comrades slept. The clear sky above offered meager starlight, supplemented by the weak shine of Quell hanging out there in the void. Too small to serve as a proper moon, too muted to be taken for a star. But seeing the planet reminded Elith of how the two worlds shared a sky, at least in impression. The stars, of course, weren't the same here as she had come to know them under Quell's nightly veil. But in the broad sweep, it would be easy to mistake one for the other. Out here on the edge of the galaxy, at the farthest ends of the Ascendance's empire of worlds, the heavens displayed the vast gulf between life and emptiness. The stars were all crowded toward one half of the sky, huddled together as the last brilliant refugees escaping the infinite darkness. On practically every other planet inhabited by citizens of the mighty Ascendance, the night served as a reminder of humanity's astonishing mastery over the physical universe. From deeper within the Empire, it was nearly impossible to see a star that hadn't been reached, studied, cultivated by their collective hand. And for every star touched, worlds followed, majestic dwellings for the ever-growing populace, nurtured through the wisdom of the First House and the power of the Hezra under the beneficent direction of the Grand Council. But out here, at the very end of its reach, even that galactic span seemed insignificant against the backdrop of all that remained beyond its grasp. For all its local dominance, the Ascendance had still not unlocked the secret to crossing the void between galaxies. And so that which seemed so incomprehensibly omnipotent from within was revealed as weak and inconsequential from without. She lingered a few moments longer by the entrance to her quarters, breathing the mild night air, listening to the gentle sounds of the environment as the light wind stole through grass and trees, seemingly reluctant to draw attention to itself. It was impossible for her to ignore the absence of other common signs of life, insect chirps
or the occasional call or cry from nocturnal birds and beasts. The land bore a winter's stillness.
"Trouble sleeping?"
a quiet voice said from the darkness. Elith, startled at its sound, snapped her head in its direction. A dark silhouette stood 5 yards away, and though she couldn't distinguish features, she recognized the shape of the man. Arbiter Oyun. His body was turned, facing outward from the camp, but he seemed to have his head turned in her direction. How long he'd been standing there, or how she'd failed to notice his presence, she had no idea.
"Sorry to startle you," he said. "I wasn't sure how else to announce myself."
Elith approached with careful steps, glancing around to see who else might be lurking under the stars.
"I'm usually much harder to surprise," she said. "Must be losing my edge."
"Long day," Oyun answered. "Strange circumstances. I wouldn't judge yourself too harshly."
It was too dark to read his expression, but she could hear the kind smile in his words.
"I'd like to say it's because I have so much on my mind," Elith said, "but that seems like a silly excuse to offer a man in your position. I can't imagine what you must be dealing with."
Oyun chuckled and shifted. She could see his face in profile now as he looked off into the black wilderness beyond their camp.
"Oh, I don't know. When you get right down to it, it's all just a little science with a good dose of math. This would probably be trivially easy if I were any good at either.
Forgive me if I don't take you at your word, Arbiter. I suspect you're misrepresenting yourself by several orders of magnitude."
"A matter of perspective, my dear. If you compared what I know to all that there is that one could know, I assure you that you would find the delta is practically infinite. For all intents and purposes, I know nothing."
"You are a man great in both intellect and humility, I see."
"Not humble enough to reject your flattery, I fear," he said, his smile shaping his words again. "You are kind, and I can hardly tell you're patronizing me."
"That certainly wasn't my intent."
"Oh, think nothing of it. You are being polite, and I take no offense. But I'm fully aware that your understanding of our universe dwarfs my little scratchings at its surface," Oyun said.
He drew a deep breath and raised his head to look at the heavens above them. When he spoke again, his voice was lower, his words pensive, tinted with melancholy.
"I may be able to describe it crudely on a good day. I know the formulas for the basics, I suppose. But if I were brazen enough to think I knew anything, I might suggest that you understand it in a way that defies description. I've done little more than read about it. You have lived it. I might be tempted to say I was envious if I didn't also suspect that there's a price you've paid for that understanding, one far beyond my capacity to bear."
Elith stood silent at the Arbiter's surprising response to her. The words came from him so easily, she could tell that the thoughts he was sharing weren't impulsive or unconsidered. They had the weight of deep rumination, almost of confession, as though he'd long waited for the chance to speak them. And they seemed built upon a foundation of genuine respect for the First House and its work as keeper of the deep language.
"But listen to me rambling on," he said, lightening the moment.
Unexpectedly, he sat down on the ground as he continued to speak.
"Or rather, don't. Sorry, I'm a foolish old man up well past my bedtime. I probably shouldn't have taken all those naps while the envoy was away."
Elith sensed the implicit invitation, and after a moment's hesitation, she joined the Arbiter on the ground, sitting cross-legged beside him.
"You are a fascinating man, Arbiter," Elith said. "I don't believe I've ever had the pleasure of meeting another quite like you."
"Lucky for me. I'm sure if you had, you wouldn't be so forthcoming with your praise. Given your rank and the caliber of the others assembled to support your work here, somehow I doubt you're the fool of the Hezra, sir."
"The Hezra Ka may disagree with your assessment," Oyun said.
"The Hezra Ka would disagree with many of my assessments," Elith replied. "That doesn't mean he's right." Oyun chuckled.
"Well, You didn't hear it from me, but those who sit in authority are just as given to misjudgment as the rest of us, he said. And as though it struck him as an afterthought, a moment later he added, as I am certain you are all too well aware, I admit I can't fathom why the First House would release a woman of your quality into the wild, let alone force her there. Only because you don't know me, Arbiter. Perhaps. But I may know you better than you think. Varen certainly thinks highly of you.
A lightning surge coursed through Elith at the mention of Varen's name. It was so unexpected, so out of place, it seemed like a carefully planned, precisely timed, emotional ambush. And though the Arbiter didn't turn to look at her, she knew he was intently tuned to her reaction. You've spoken with him? She asked. She had known him as Eth Amuin and could not call him by the other name.
I have, he answered. At length.
Oyun put subtle but unusual emphasis on the words, and with their implicit meaning, Elith saw the conversation up to this point in an entirely new light. This was no casual midnight banter. He had something to tell her, something he was sure the envoy didn't want her to know.
Since his capture after Quell? She asked. And before, he answered. Long before.
Long before. That would mean the Arbiter hadn't just known about the Hezra operation on Quell. He'd been part of the secret work there to dissect Varen's understanding of the deep language and to incorporate what they learned into Hezra technology. The blending of the two had been expressly forbidden since the founding of the Ascendants. In a flash, Oyun's admission transformed him in her mind from a kindly researcher to the worst sort of architect of destruction. A man who understood the potential for catastrophic harm his work could unleash, and who undertook it anyway. Elith kept her words as neutral as she was able. You were involved with the work on Quell?
It's worse than that, my dear, he said. I was the chief technical officer for that initiative. When we began our collaboration with Varen, I was the one who selected Quell as the site for his release. And our research.
Elith sat quietly, absorbing the information, letting it swirl and settle into place, allowing it to integrate with all she had known up to that point, and all that she hadn't.
So, Oyun said after her lack of a response, perhaps now you see how I am indeed the fool of the Hezra.
You were in charge of Deep Cutter? Elith asked. The covert program had been the Hezra's prime initiative for untold years, the project to at last crack the secrets of intergalactic travel, to open the universe to the Ascendance's continued expansion. She had only known about it because of her high rank within the First House, and even that had been unauthorized.
Deep Cutter? I've never heard that name, he said, in a tone that clearly indicated he had, and then leaned toward her briefly. But yes, that was the one. And Varen taught you the deep language?
I'm not sure I'd say that exactly. In his way, I suppose, but only enough to show me how little I actually knew.
He sat back and sighed heavily.
The universe has a way of chastening us in proportion to our hubris, and mine was perhaps the greatest in the history of our ancient race. So my time here on Quell's shadow is my penance. Mine, far more than yours. I fear, however, that it is beyond my capacity to repair on my own.
I'm not sure why you're telling me any of this, Elith said, allowing a measure of her disgust to seep into her words. I have no absolution to offer you.
Oh, of course, yes. Sorry, I'm not looking for anything from you. I suspect the full measure of my punishment is yet to be meted out.
but I do feel it's important for you to know the truth, or as much of it as you can, anyway. I hold a strong belief that you can't find the optimal solution to a problem without first properly identifying the actual problem you're trying to solve. Then I don't see how any of that is relevant to the problem at hand, Arbiter, unless you're planning to tell me precisely what it was that he taught you. Oyun chuckled again, but without humor. Ultimately, he taught me that I didn't even know the right questions to ask, he said. I worked on Deep Cutter for almost 30 years, always chasing the idea that our challenge to intergalactic travel was one of distance, that it was the same problem set we had already solved, just of a greater degree. It was only recently that I came to understand there's something else going on, something too subtle or too fundamental, perhaps, for our instruments and techniques to notice. The nature of space within our galaxy is different from that which lies beyond it, and I suppose that's where Varen was most helpful. If nothing else, he showed me that I was trying to solve the wrong problem.
While he was helping you, did you know he was also changing Quell?
Yes, Oyun said, and no. I knew he was doing something. He was meticulous, deeply thoughtful, testing his concepts with great care. We were monitoring the health of the planet, and his work didn't appear to be destructive. It wasn't until the first house took interest that we realized we might not know what exactly we should have been watching for. Hubris, again.
And then, rather than letting the truth be known, you tried to destroy it?
In part. I can't speak to what percentage of that decision was based on protecting the reputation of the Hezra. Greater than zero, certainly. But we did realize the danger of losing control of Quell. If there'd been any other way, I would have preferred it. Unfortunately, the contingency was the only tool we had at the time to fully correct the situation.
That seems to be a hallmark of the Hezra, Elith said. To assume you're capable of controlling things beyond your comprehension.
A fair assessment. If we were being charitable, I would say the hierarchy had a pretty good track record of doing so, up until recently. But your point is well taken.
And we're repeating the mistake here, on this world, trying to control it without understanding what it is.
It does appear to be our way. But I hope you see now why we need you here. We're learning that we still have more to learn, late though it might be.
Elith shook her head in the darkness. What makes you think I could find anything that the first team couldn't?
A hunch only, Oyun replied. I have a hypothesis that this place was born out of the interaction between the power of the contingency and whatever it was that you and Varen did on Quell, to protect it from destruction. If that's true, perhaps there's some affinity between Quell and its shadow, something inherent that only you would recognize.
Strikes me as an awful lot riding on a hunch.
Indeed.
But that's the nature of my work.
Making my very best guesses and then proving myself wrong.
He leaned forward and took a deep breath. In it, Elith heard both relief after his confession, and also resolve for what lay ahead.
When morning comes, Oyun continued, my work will begin in earnest. I've told you all of this to give you a more complete picture of our situation, but I have also told you all of this in hopes that you'll understand the strength of my commitment to correcting whatever imbalance I've invited into our empire. The fault is mine, more than anyone's, and so must be the responsibility to repair the damage. I know I said I wasn't looking for absolution, and that remains true, but for whatever it's worth, I am sorry that you are bearing the burden of my mistakes, my dear. If I believed I could fix this without involving you, I would. But because my errors have caused such hardship for you, I want you to at least know that I'm willing to face whatever I must to correct them. I am here until the end, whatever that end
Maybe.
The two sat quietly in the darkness for a time, Elith pondering the many revelations, and Oyun apparently content to let her do so. She'd spent the past few years reflecting on the chain of events that had led her to exile. Now she saw how much further back in time that chain of causality stretched, and how much smaller her role in it all had been than she had previously believed. Within that new expanded context, she felt more like a cog in a great galactic machine than the commander of her own fate that she thought she'd become. If the Arbiter had been waiting for a response, she wasn't sure what to offer him. Her thoughts were too many and her emotions too complex to distill them into any meaningful statement. Neither judgment nor forgiveness seemed fully appropriate. If nothing else, Oyun's admission did at least tell her that this was no mere scientific curiosity to him, and revealed the depth of his resolve. Whether or not his resolve could truly withstand the pressure of the shadow remained to be seen. Given enough time, either of them may have had more to say to the other. As it was, the moment was fractured by a brilliant sheet of white light casting out from the northeastern quadrant of the camp. The light poured across the clearing all the way into the first few feet of the tree line beyond. The camp's interior lights glowed to life. A piercing alarm followed, and only a handful of seconds later, the sight erupted with troopers. Both Elith and Oyun shot to their feet, but stood frozen in place, unsure how to respond. The Hezra troopers showed no such uncertainty. Despite the late hour and the mind-breaking sound of the alarm, the Hezra personnel moved like a single clockwork unit, some snapping into position to focus on the threat area, while others secured the flanks. It was speed without haste, smooth aggression in motion. Nieta came out of her quarters, eyes half wild with the shock of violent waking.
"What's going on?" she called.
"No idea," Elith answered.
"Let's go see,"
Oyun said, and without waiting for a reply, he started off at a trot toward the front line. Elith and Nieta exchanged a brief look, and it was hard to know which of them had the greater fear. Elith's mind conjured the image of a rolling wave of those abyssal creatures rushing the compound. But Nieta had only heard tell of the beast. There was no knowing what she might imagine emerging from that black wilderness. Elith was the first to turn to follow after Oyun. Nieta's footsteps fell in close behind. Vanquin, the gunship, spun up its engines as they crossed the site, lending a low growl to the sound of the alarm. Elith and Nieta caught up with the Arbiter as he was being intercepted by Tal, a few yards behind the perimeter.
"Return to your quarters, sir,"
she ordered as she stepped in his path. She was fully kitted up, armed with a large rifle, and her eyes showed battle intensity.
"All of you, get back to your quarters!"
"What's happening?" Oyun asked.
"Sir, you need to get inside. It's not safe for you." "Sergeant, you do not give me orders," Oyun interrupted.
And the authority and booming volume of his voice took Elith and apparently Tal by complete surprise.
"Sir," Tal said in acknowledgement, "I'd request that you at least stay behind me."
"What exactly is happening?" Oyun said, stern but quieter.
"Not sure yet," Tal answered. "Picked up motion out there, headed this way. Something massive."
She glanced at her comrades stationed at the edge of camp, poised to engage the threat closing in on the site. Elith and the others with her all followed Tal's look, watching the woodline for the first sign of whatever terror it was about to unleash. Vanquin leaped off the ground and swept into a supporting position, holding a low hover just outside the camp, and angled to lend its overwhelming power to the troopers below.
"Are the drones up?"
Oyun asked.
"Any second," Tal said.
and as if they'd been waiting for her command, three small craft rose out of a housing bay nearby and then zoomed off toward the tree line. The bright floodlights of the camp only filtered into a few rows of trees of the forest. Beyond it, a wall of night stood impenetrable. The drones added their support from above, switching on broad sweeping searchlights as they fanned out across the clearing. Elith followed the intense oval starlight of the drone's searchlights, racing across the ground, scanning for the first sign of the threat. When the drones reached the limit of the floodlights, however, there was nothing else beyond to be seen. Literally nothing. Elith watched intently as the blackness of the wild swallowed any attempt to peer deeper. Whenever a drone returned to the tree line, its pool of light reappeared. But as soon as the craft moved farther into the wilderness, its light vanished once more from the surface of the ground. After a minute or two of zipping back and forth, the drones settled into loiter, following lazy orbits around the threat area. Vanquin left its station then, roaring off to investigate. Shortly after, the alarm ceased, and the troopers around the perimeter eased up. No one left their positions, but several people clustered together, undoubtedly discussing whatever had just happened. "False alarm?" Elith asked. "Not exactly," Tal said, shaking her head. She listened to the chatter on her comms for a moment, and then signaled to Oyun. "Sardis is looking for you. By the tower up there." She pointed to a guard platform nearby. "I'm sure he is," the Arbiter said. Oyun headed off toward the platform, and Elith followed without hesitation, Nieta by her side. The envoy was waiting for them, flanked by Karush and Subo. He glanced at the Arbiter's uninvited escort as they arrived, but neither greeted nor dismissed them.
"Arbiter," he said, "we're going for a ride."
Oyun nodded his consent, but said nothing further. His eyes were fixed on the tree line. A few moments later, a utility skimmer cruised up, the ground-hugging variety, with a doorless bubble canopy and open-top flatbed that the Hezra used for hauling supplies. When it came to a stop in front of them, Elith saw that Captain Ames was in the pilot seat, with a hard look on his face. Sardis hopped into the other seat in the open-air cockpit, and Oyun, Karush, and Subo climbed into the back. While they were still getting situated, Ames glanced over at Elith and Nieta, and then gave a quick jerk of his head toward the skimmer's bed. That was all the prompting Elith needed. She grabbed the side wall of the bed and lightly levered herself up and in. Karush flashed a questioning look, which she answered by sitting down next to Oyun.
"Aspirant,"
Nieta said, and Elith realized her mistake.
"My apologies, advocate," she said, standing once more and turning to address Nieta with a formal posture of deference. "Will you permit me to accompany the Arbiter?"
"In or out, we gotta move," Ames answered before anyone else could.
"Very well, you may," Nieta said. "Report back to me immediately on your return."
"Yes, advocate," Elith replied as she retook her seat.
Nieta kept her eyes fixed on Elith for a moment and then briefly flicked her gaze to Karush. Elith followed the look, saw Karush staring back at Nieta with a subtle expression Elith couldn't read. He dipped his head in a shallow nod, acknowledging Nieta. There was something between them Elith hadn't seen before. Nieta remained standing by, her arms crossed as the skimmer accelerated and everyone's full attention went to the fast approaching border between light and darkness. Ames brought the skimmer to a stop within 10 yards of the tree line. Sardis was the first one out, marching with such purpose toward the woods that Elith had the impression the man was about to unleash a stinging verbal rebuke on the wilderness itself. He had a sidearm in hand, the first time she'd seen him armed at all. Karush and Subo flowed out of the back of the skimmer and quickly caught up with the envoy. Ames, Oyun, and Elith dismounted and followed, a few steps behind with a greater measure of care. Sardis stopped where the light did and stared into the blackness, posture suggesting anger at whatever was out there. When Elith reached him, it became apparent why he'd stopped and why the light did as well. The ground was gone. A chasm had opened, sheer and of unknown depth. But the edge wasn't jagged or unstable. The earth hadn't broken open or collapsed, as in an earthquake or vast sinkhole. It was as worn and weathered as though the terrain had been shaped by natural forces over centuries, rather than violently created mere minutes before.
"Well," Ames said, but he didn't continue.
Sardis snatched a device off his belt and stabbed a few strokes on it with his finger. A few moments later, one of the drones loitering overhead swung over and began a slow descent, illuminating the face of the wall below them as it went. Elith leaned out to peer into the fresh canyon. Ames took hold of her arm with gentle firmness to keep her steady. The chasm appeared to have a rocky face, with a few strange shapes jutting out here and there that didn't look fully natural. They were too smooth and rounded in places, too many angles and straight lines in others. But the top-down perspective and the shifting light from the descending drone made it difficult to judge what she was seeing. The envoy fiddled with the device again, less violently this time, and the drone below paused, rose a few feet, and then hovered with its light trained on one of the angled shapes. He was the first one to recognize what they were looking at.
"It would appear we have discovered the landing site of our first expedition," he said.
And once he'd said it, recognition came. It was a winglet from a craft, partially merged with the landscape, but undamaged as far as Elith could tell.
"And," Oyun said quietly, "it looks like my work begins now."